Hello and welcome to Gin and Spooks. I'm Emma.
I'm Laura.
And what are we talking about today, Laura?
We are talking about stalkers. We always woo these really bad topics.
Yeah.
We shouldn't be wooing stalkers. Anyway, that's what we're talking about.
Are you drinking anything today?
Just water and Pepsi Max because it is 3 p.m. on a Saturday.
It certainly is. I'm drinking iced tea from KFC.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, had a cuff.
Nice.
Right.
Tasty.
Shall I start with my facts? Okay. So, stalking is unwanted and or repeated surveillance by an individual or group toward another person. Stalker behaviours are interrelated to harassment and intimidation and may include following the victim in person or monitoring them. The term stalking is used with some differing definitions in psychiatry and psychology, as well as in some legal jurisdictions as a term for a criminal offence. My ability to be able to read my writing is going well so far.
Woo!
Woo! People characterised as stalkers may be accused of having a mistaken belief that another person loves them, which is also known as erotomania, or that they need rescuing. Stalking can consist of an accumulation of a series of actions which by themselves can be legal, such as calling on the phone, sending gifts, or sending emails. Stalkers may use overt and covert intimidation, threats, and violence to frighten their victims. They may engage in vandalism and property damage or make physical attacks that are meant to frighten the victim. Less common are sexual assaults. Intimate partner stalkers are the most dangerous type. In the UK, for example, most stalkers are former partners and evidence indicates that mental illness facilitated stalking propagated in the media accounts for only a minority of cases of alleged stalking. A UK Home Office research study on the use of the Protection from Harassment Act stated, the study found that the Protection from Harassment Act is being used to deal with a variety of behaviours such as domestic and inter-neighbour disputes. It is rarely used for stalking as portrayed by the media since only a small minority of cases in the survey involved such behaviour. So the psychological effects on victims, so disruptions in daily life necessary to escape the stalker, including changes in employment, residence, and phone numbers, can take a toll on the victim's well-being and may lead to a sense of isolation. According to a psychologist called Lambert, stalking is a form of mental assault in which the perpetrator I'm not even drunk, Jesus. Repeatedly, unwantedly, and disruptively breaks into the life world of the victim with whom they have no relationship or no longer have that relationship. Moreover, the separated acts that make up the intrusion cannot by themselves cause the mental abuse, but do taking together. Oh my God. Which is also known as a cumulative effect. Stalking as a close relationship. So stalking has also been described as a form of close relationship between the partner, albeit a disjunctive one where the participants have opposing goals rather than cooperative goals. One participant, often a woman, likely wishes to end the relationship entirely but may find herself unable to do so easily. The other participant, often but not always a man, wishes to escalate the relationship. It has been described as a close relationship because the duration, frequency, and intensity of contact may rival that of a more traditional conjunctive dating relationship. So, types of victims. So, based on work with the stalking victims for 8 years in Australia, Mullen and Paffey, who are psychologists, identified different types of stalking victims dependent on their previous relationship to the stalker. These are, so the first one is prior intimates. So victims who have been in a previous intimate relationship with their stalker. In the article, Mullen described this as being the largest category, the most common victim profile, being a woman who has previously shared an intimate relationship with her usually male stalker.
Mm.
These victims are more likely to be exposed to violence, being enacted by the stalker, especially if the stalker had a criminal past. In addition, victims who have, in quotation marks, date stalkers are less likely to experience violence by their stalkers. A date stalker is considered an individual who had an intimate relationship with the victim, but it was short-lived.
So it's basically a lot of people getting too obsessed with someone they're dating and then it ending sooner than they like and then just going a bit nuts.
Like, rereading the research and I'm like, yeah, sounds about right. It's like men don't have the capacity to be able to be like just friends with a woman if they're sexually attracted to them.
Yeah.
They have to like go the extra mile.
The patriarchy.
Yeah. Oh, fuck men and the patriarchy. The second one is casual acquaintances and friends. So among male stalking victims, most are part of this category. This category of victims also include neighbour stalking. Certain professions such as healthcare providers, teachers and lawyers are at a higher risk for stalking. Then you have professional contacts. So these are victims who have been stalked by patients, clients or students who they have had a professional relationship with. Certain professions, again, such as healthcare providers, teachers and lawyers, are at higher risk of stalking.
People are just creepy, aren't they? It's just so unnecessary.
Yeah, like consent. No one ever heard that.
Clearly not.
Swiping, no swiping. That should be the slogan. Like
it should.
Swiping, no swiping. Workplace contacts. So the stalkers of these victims had to visit them in the workplace, which means they are either an employer, an employee, or a customer. When victims have stalkers come into the workplace, this poses a threat not only to the victim, but to the safety of others as well. And then you have strangers. So these victims typically unaware of how the stalkers began stalking because they're, you know, typically strangers who gain like a sense of admiration from a distance from their victims.
Mm.
And then you have the famous. So most of these victims are individuals who are portrayed heavily on social media outlets, but can also include individuals such as politicians and athletes.
Oh God, imagine stalking Boris Johnson. Ugh.
The only time I'd be stalking Boris Johnson is so I can bloody egg him and just be like, you shit.
Yes. Yeah.
Like that is the only time I'd go out of my way to find where he is.
Was it Nigel Farage that got hit in the face by a milkshake? Which politician was it?
No, I think it was Farage. When he was visiting, like, he was, for some reason, he was in Stoke. And this guy that I went to uni with, he was the person that, like, had thrown something at him.
No way. That's amazing. What a legend.
Yeah. I can't remember if it was a milkshake or they, like, egged him. But either way, he was involved and it was great. Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. So gender, according to one study, women target women, whereas men primarily stalk women. So women just have a real good time being alive.
Oh, yeah, lucky us.
A January 2009 report from the United States Department of Justice reports males were as likely being stalked by a male as by a female offender, which is 43% of male stalking victims stated that they were female, while 41% of male victims stated that the offender was another male. So female victims of stalking were significantly more likely to be stalked by a male, which is 67%, rather than a female, which is 24%. This report provides considerable data by gender and race about both stalking and harassment, obtained by the 2006 Supplemental Victimization Survey by the US Census Bureau for the US Department of Justice. In an article in the journal Sex Roles, Jennifer, I can't say her last name, it looks like Rowling, but yeah, discusses how gender plays a role in the difference between stalkers and victims. She says gender is associated with the types of emotional reactions that are experienced by recipients of stalking-related events, including the degree of fear. In addition, she hypothesizes that gender may also affect how police handle a case of stalking. So how the victim copes with the situation and how the stalker might view their behavior. She discusses how victims might view certain forms of stalking as normal because of gender socialization.
Gross.
And the influence on the acceptability of like certain behaviors. She emphasizes that in the UK, Australia, and the US, strangers are considered more dangerous when it comes to stalking than a former partner. Since gender roles are socially constructed, sometimes men don't report stalking. She also mentions coercive control theory. So future research will be needed to determine if this theory can predict how changes in social structures and gender-specific norms will result in variations in rates of stalking for men versus women over in the US and across the world.
Women just have a bad time, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, based on that alone, like, it, you know, a lot of behaviours are deemed as, like, normal.
Yeah.
Even though they're not. So, you know, like, when you have someone that's consistently in your space and is, like, you know, putting their hand on your shoulder or, like,
yeah,
you know, just touching you, like, in a non-threatening way, but they haven't asked for your permission. That's, yeah, like, more acceptable now, and it's, like, can you not touch me?
Also, did you say that men are least likely to report that they're being stalked, especially if it's by a woman? But that, I reckon women report it more because men are scarier. Men can do more damage to women than, well, no, let me see how to phrase this. Men are more likely to be able to overpower and do physical damage to a woman than women are to men. I'm not saying that it's not possible for it to be the other way around, but it's more likely that a man can overpower a woman than the other way around. So, of course, women are going to be more likely to report it. But then at the same time, I think women are less likely to be believed by the police and members of authority.
Yeah. Like, oh, what's it called now? It's that TV. It's like a series on Netflix, and it's about this girl, and she gets there's a home invasion, but she gets raped during this home invasion, but because she doesn't know or hasn't seen the person's like face, like it goes on to like this whole court case and how literally no one believes her because he was like in and out, like no one saw him, there was no evidence. The only thing was she remembered waking up and he was like raping her.
Oh, that's horrible.
I can't even remember what it's called, but it's like a TV series on Netflix and it's really good. But essentially, like, you know, she does get people to believe her, but
like, I vaguely remember.
Well, there's two female police officers and it's set in America, and one of them doesn't believe her. It's like, you're female, how would you feel if no one believed you when you were being raped?
Yeah,
and shit like horrific. That, like,
yeah.
And then you've got types of stalkers. So psychologists often group stalkers into two categories, so psychotic and non-psychotic. Some stalkers may have pre-existing psychotic disorders, such as delusional disorder, schizoaffective disorder, or schizophrenia. However, most stalkers are non-psychotic and may exhibit disorders or neurosis, such as major depression adjustment disorder or substance dependence, as well as a variety of personality disorders such as antisocial, borderline, or narcissistic. The non-psychotic stalker's pursuit of victims is primarily angry, vindictive, focused, often including projection of blame, obsession, dependency, minimization, denial, and jealousy. Conversely, only 70% of stalkers had an erotomaniac delusional disorder.
Yeah.
So in a study named A Study of Stalkers by Mullen in 2000 identified five types of stalkers. So you've got rejected stalkers. So they follow their victims in order to reverse, correct, or avenge a rejection. So that can be through like being divorced, separated, like termination of a relationship. And then number two is resentful stalkers. So they make a vendetta because of a sense of grievance against the victim, motivated mainly by the desire to frighten and distress the victim.
That's my story, is kind of around that one, I think.
Oh, intimacy seekers. So seek to establish an intimate loving relationship with their victim, such as stalkers often believe that the victim is a long sought after soulmate and they were meant to be together. Then you have incompetent suitors. So despite poor social or courting skills, have a fixation of, in some cases, a sense of entitlement to an intimate relationship with those who have attracted their amorous interest. The victims most often already are in another relationship with someone else. And then the last one is predatory stalkers. So spy on the victim in order to prepare and plan an attack, often sexual, on the victim. In addition to Mullen, Joseph A. Davis, PhD. No, you're knocking the thing over, Toothless. Jesus.
He just wants to be a part of it.
You just are.
That ear fluff is adorable.
Oh, wait. What's the other side? Can you see? No, he's consistently moving his head. Anyway, in addition to Mullen, Joseph A. Davis, PhD in American researcher, crime analyst, and university psychology professor at San Diego State University, investigated as a member of the Stalking Case Assessment Team, special unit with the San Diego District Attorney's Office, hundreds of cases involving what he called and typed terrestrial and cyber stalking between 1995 and 2002. This research culminated in one of the most comprehensive books written to date on the subject. So the 2002 National Victim Association Academy defines an additional form of stalking, the vengeance terrorist stalker. So both the vengeance and terrorist stalker do not, in contrast with some of the other stalkers mentioned, seek a personal relationship with their victims, but rather force them to emit a certain response. Well, the vengeance stalker's motive is to get even with the other person whom she or he perceives has done some wrong to them. The political stalker intends to accomplish a political agenda, also using threats and intimidation to force the target to refrain or become involved in some particular activity, regardless of the victim's consent. So, for example, most prosecutions in this stalking category have been against anti-abortionists who stalk doctors in an attempt to discourage the performance of abortions. Which, you know, is like pathetic, but yeah. And then stalkers may fit categories with paranoia disorders. Intimacy seeking partners often have delusional disorders involving erotomanic delusions. With projected stalkers, the continual clinging to a relationship of an inadequate or dependent person couples with the entitlement of the narcissistic personality. In contrast, resentful stalkers demonstrate an almost pure culture of persecution with delusional disorders of the paranoid type, paranoid personalities, and paranoid schizophrenia. And that is all for my notes about stalking.
Good shit. I mean, it's not good shit. It just shows how creepy people can get. And people need to learn to take no for an answer.
Yeah, a lot of it I think is related to like if they've got like a mental illness or some sort of personality disorder, which yeah. may, you know, if it's not treated, can lead to stalking.
Yeah, I mean, that's not an excuse, and not everyone who has those things obviously stalks people. Yeah. But still, yeah, it's one of those things that sometimes goes hand in hand with something like this.
Yeah.
So, my story is a bit of a wild ride.
Okay.
I was going to say, and I don't want to ruin it for you or give you any spoilers, as if it was like a film or something that I've written, and I haven't. It's a true story, but just don't judge everyone. Don't judge anyone until the end. Like, okay.
Oh, okay. I'll wait until the end.
Yeah. I mean, you can judge Ian the whole way through if you want, because men. Okay, so Michelle Headley met Ian Diaz through an online dating website in 2013. So at the time, good old dating websites. Haha.
I hate them so much.
I think Michelle came to hate them too. So at the time, Michelle was 26. She was a self-confessed goody two-shoes. Like, she'd been a good student at school. She was on the cross-country running team. Bit of a nerd. She earned a scholarship for college, and she got ended up where she ended up getting her bachelor's degree in medieval studies. She then worked as choice. Once she graduated, she worked as a marketing executive for her No, for an insurance company in Orange County, California. So this whole thing is set in California. Her only previous relationship had been with her high school sweetheart. She'd got married to him at age 22. And then a few years later, she divorced him. And then that's why she signed up to these dating sites, because she was recently divorced.
Okay.
So Ian, he was a 35-year-old US deputy marshal. So he worked for the police force. He enjoyed working in law enforcement so much that all his friends were cops, and he built his whole life slash identity around the fact that he was a cop. It's reported that sometimes he wore his uniform on his days off, so he quite clearly loved his job. I mean, cannot relate, but to each their own.
Yeah.
So, Ian was quite an intense dude. He told Michelle that he loved her on their second date. Things moved very quickly from there. He ended up convincing her to quit her job that she loved and work full-time at Disneyland, which is his favourite place in the entire world. She did this even though she suffered a substantial pay cut for her 28th birthday in December 2014, which is only a few months after they'd met. He proposed to her on top of the Rockefeller Center during a trip to New York. They then bought a puppy together, which was a Yorkshire Terrier named Chewy. And they found a two-bedroom condo in a brand new development just half a mile away from Disneyland in Anaheim. Michelle covered the $14,000 down payment, and they got a mortgage together to pay off the remainder. You know, it's, things are going well, apparently.
Okay.
By the time they moved into the condo a month or so later, the relationship had become toxic. They were constantly arguing, accusations flying in both directions. At one point, Ian accused Michelle of cheating on him, and she responded by saying that he drove her to it. She is reported to have shouted things like, "I hate you, I hate this house, and if it were up to me, I'd burn this motherfucker down." It got worse.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. It got worse and worse until, less than 2 months after moving in together, Michelle moved back to live with her parents and Ian stayed in the condo with Chewy. He told his workmates that he could no longer deal with her emotional instability and he had kicked her out. So, Michelle was angry that Ian had stayed in the condo. They were both paying the mortgage and it was her that had paid the down payment. A few days after she moved out, she started emailing him incessantly, demanding to know what was going to happen with the property. Ian responded saying he hadn't decided yet, seeing as you left only 4 days ago after confirming to me that you were having affairs with multiple men. At first, she seemed willing to work out an agreement on the condo. However, it didn't take long before her emails took a bizarre turn. And then I've got some quotes from her emails here. "Your wicked sins are many, including defiling me and my family with your wicked and evil sexual acts, your financial coercion and irresponsibility, your gluttony, your greed, your lust, your sloth, your wrath, your envy, and most of all, your pride. I will bring the full force of the law and the word of God against you to judge you." Mm.
Okay.
She names the seven deadly sins there. Like, she goes on.
Right, why are you going to bring Jesus into it?
I know. Ian's reply was, "I'm not sure how God, the Bible, or my childhood has any relevance to the condo and the mortgage," which, you know, he's got a point.
Yeah.
And then she said, "You know exactly how God, the word of God, the spirit of God are involved with the condo. We both do. Your end will come and you will relinquish the keys to the earth. Earth is mine and the title deed to earth belongs to me. There will be no resolution outside of court unless you are willing to bow before the Lord your God. If you are not, then prepare yourself, Satan. So let it be written. So let it be done." These emails were interspersed. I know. These emails were interspersed with normal polite emails. Just every so often he'd get this, and then every so often it'd be like, "Please, can I have some money?" Yeah. And then she said, "Please explain to your real estate attorney that God's law is above all laws. Prepare yourself and prepare your armies." She sounds quite scary.
Off, you Bible basher. Like, I can't stand when people have to argue with another person and bring in, like, religion into it. I can't.
I know.
It's like an ick.
Yeah.
Like, stop.
Yeah. Michelle During the next few months, she moved into a tiny apartment near Chapman University where she was taking classes. She quit her job at Disneyland and got a new marketing role at a loan company, which is the kind of thing she was doing before that she loved. Not long after this, Ian received a phone call from the university saying he was not allowed to set foot on campus, as Michelle had told her supervisor that he was armed and she was scared of him. Meanwhile, Michelle kept sending Ian emails that were becoming increasingly unhinged. She accused him of being violent with her and assaulting her, as well as pressuring her into having sex with a random man on camera. Another snippet from her email. You do not get any woman, let alone the woman you purport to love, drunk and find a random man for her to have sex with whilst you make a pornographic video of her. That is rape, which is against the law. Luckily, there are plenty of text messages and a video to prove that you and the man you found coerced me sexually. So basically, she's accusing him here of finding a stranger and forcing her to have sex with this stranger whilst he recorded it.
Okay.
So in September 2015, he filed a restraining order against Michelle. In his petition, he said that after showing emails and messages from Michelle to his superior, he had been advised to seek a domestic violence restraining order. He wrote that at times he was so scared for his own safety that he had his mum come and stay with him at the condo. He repeated that she had cheated on him multiple times, and at one point she apparently had grabbed their puppy by the neck in a rage and yelled, "Don't make me hurt you." However, on Michelle's side, Michelle kept repeating her allegations that Ian had forced her to have sex with strangers whilst he secretly filmed them and watched from another room, that he was mentally and emotionally abusive towards her and that she was afraid of him, especially because he owned multiple guns. I mean, he's a policeman, so, and it's America, yeah. So obviously guns everywhere. She blamed the weird emails as a side effect of her PTSD from being in the relationship and the relationship breakdown, and that she was coming to the end of her tether because he wouldn't come to an agreement on about the condo. So yeah, he's still living in this apartment that she's paying half the mortgage on, and he's just living there. So Ian's request for a restraining order was refused 3 weeks later. And then together, Ian and Michelle came to an agreement about the condo in around, it was now November 2015. Ian would pay Michelle $3,000 and then would remain in the condo for 6 months whilst he sorted out his finances. At the end of the 6 months, he was to either pay off her half of the mortgage or move out so they could sell the property and split the profit. However, in January 2016, Ian meets a woman called Angela on the same dating website where he met Michelle. Once again, things moved very quickly. Less than a month after they met, Ian proposes and Angela says yes. 2 weeks after they announce their engagement, Angela announces she's pregnant. So they decide they should move in together as soon as possible. On the 19th of February, Ian comes home from work to find that Angela has just moved all of her stuff into the condo that is still part owned by Michelle, and the condo that Ian probably is going to have to sell come July if he doesn't get approved to take over the full mortgage. So enter a third party into this crazy situation. Like, Angela wasn't working, she had no health insurance, and because she's pregnant, they decided to get married as soon as possible so she'd be included in his government benefits. So on the 22nd of February, which is 3 days after she moved in and only 51 days after they met in person for the first time, they were married in a small courthouse ceremony. Like,
what the fuck, man? I know. They do know it takes about 5 years for you to fully learn and understand another person.
Yeah.
No wonder divorce rate is so high.
I know, right? So in April, she has a miscarriage. So she's no longer pregnant, but then apparently they started trying again straight away. And then less than a month later, Ian comes home from work and she greets him at the door with a positive pregnancy test. She then returns home from a medical appointment not long after with a sonogram picture showing that she's having twins. She starts shopping for baby things and complains of the usual pregnancy symptoms such as nausea, cramping and backache. I mean, good on him for getting pregnant that soon after having a miscarriage.
Yeah, I mean, I have those symptoms just without
just life.
Child. Just because of life.
Yeah. Yeah. So the deadline on the condo is drawing nearer. Ian starts getting emails from Michelle again. He told her he is now married with babies on the way, so he hasn't been able to finalise things with the bank yet. On the 22nd of May, she writes, "You told me I was your first love, but you did not treat me like the precious, perfect treasure I am. You have sinned against God, and I want my power back because it belongs to the daughters of God." So after writing and sending this email, Michelle has a bit of a breakdown and she winds up in Arizona, where she was picked up by an ambulance. When questioned on the cause of her episode, she cited Ian as the reason and gave the medical staff reason to report Ian to the police. 2 days later, Angela, the new wife, receives the first of what would become an inundation of emails from many different email addresses signed by various different people. Most of them referenced or were like signed off from someone called Lilith. Now, as soon as I said Lilith, I thought of Sabrina's Teenage Witch, because, no, The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, sorry, because Lilith is the, she's the mother of demons, isn't she? I'm sure she's in Lucifer as well.
Yeah, she is. So she's like the first, she was the first love of Lucifer before Eve.
Yeah, so she's classified as a character in Jewish mythology, considered to be dangerous and immoral and highly sexed, who steals babies in the night. And then one of the emails says, "There are legends that Adam had a wife before Eve who was named Lilith, but this is not found in the Bible. The legends vary significantly, but they all essentially agree that Lilith left Adam because she did not want to submit to him. According to the legend, Lilith was an evil, wicked woman who committed adultery with Satan and produced a race of evil creatures. I hope you are scared of death tomorrow. Be prepared. Don't sleep. Be watchful of the daughters of God. We will steal your child and we will watch as it dies. Ian is using you for everything. Don't you see this? He is obsessed with me. I am his treasured princess. You are nothing. Watch your back tomorrow."
Fucking hell, man.
Like, yeah.
Jesus. Like, what? I'm just, as soon as someone's like, oh, you know, anything God related, I'm like, nah, peace out.
Yeah. Yeah. So another email comes from an address, lilithistruth@outlook.com, says, "You will lose your baby and it will be done by will of God. God's vengeance will rise up." So obviously the biblical, yeah. Yeah. So obviously the biblical references in these emails have the same like anger and themes that the previous emails that were definitely from Michelle had, even though these ones are coming from different email addresses. Also, Angela was getting messages through things like LinkedIn from random people. There was one that was from a person called Jason Ray, who said something like, "Michelle is his one true an honoured first love. You are nothing to him." Angela obviously knows this is Michelle, so she responds to him saying, "Michelle Hadley, I want you to please stop emailing me."
Yeah.
Other messages include, "We will steal your child and we will watch as it dies. You deserve nothing but a life of lonely torture. You are a piece of shit and I hope to God you burn for what you have done to us." So the situation was further complicated when Ian's application to take over the mortgage on the condo was denied. So under the terms of the settlement agreement, he would have to sell the property and split the proceeds with Michelle. However, he doesn't really do this. And because of all the messages, Angela and Ian apply to go to the police and apply for a restraining order. So I think to get a restraining order, you have to submit a petition first before it goes to a hearing. So in a petition, Angela wrote, "Miss Hadley has been emailing me for over 1 week, repeatedly threatening my life, my marriage, my safety, and slandering my husband. She has used over 6 different email addresses to contact me despite a request to cease communication. I'm now fearful of leaving my home, have had to delete my online presence, and I'm incredibly emotionally distressed. I am fearful of being raped, attacked, killed. I've had to completely uproot my life, including missing work at a new job to quash this issue. The tone and tenor of these emails escalates and there seems no sign of stopping." And then she attached all the messages and stuff that she'd received. And then notice of a hearing regarding the restraining order was emailed to Michelle, and a temporary restraining order was granted until then. So in California, a temporary restraining order is issued when the judge believes that the party applying is in immediate danger and needs protection before the court hears the case. It only lasts between 20 to 25 days. So this was given to Michelle. so that she was aware that she couldn't go near Angela or contact her again.
Yeah.
However, the restraining order did not make any difference. The next day, Angela started receiving emails that made it seem like Michelle was spying on her every move. Things like, I know you were leaving work. I watch as you walk. Let's play a game. What do you think? This is Saw. Let's play a game.
Someone said, like, let's play a game. I'm like, bro, if you come up to me, I will drop kick you. Like, I will yeet you over to another city in another country.
Get the hence.
Yeah. Be gone, witch. Be gone.
So, the emails are pretty aggressive already, but they keep getting more and more aggressive, talking about how they hoped Angela was ready for the pain and that she was going to burn in the fiery pits of hell. So Angela makes another report to the police saying she feared for her safety and she believes Michelle's getting her friends to spy on her and report back. The police filed official reports of stalking, criminal threats and a violation of her protection/stay-away order. When questioned by the police, Michelle insists that she hadn't sent any of the emails or done any of those things and that someone was impersonating her. She said she had emailed her ex-fiancé a couple of times, but only to discuss things like the condo, and her Bible referencing emails previously were a result of her PTSD breakdown from the end of the relationship. So, like, she ended up in an ambulance previously in Arizona. But then a week later, Ian and Angela go back to the police with another report. This time, a man had turned up at their door expecting to have rough and violent sex with Angela. The man had posted an ad in the casual encounters section on Craigslist. Basically, it's an ad that he's interested in doing a rape fantasy scenario.
Oh, God.
So the advert says, I'm looking for women who have fantasies about being raped or forced to perform. I've done this before with a couple of ex-girlfriends and found it very intense/exciting. We would agree on the limits beforehand and could meet at a safe location, like a hotel. Which is just a complete twisted thing. I mean, at least he's not going out and actually raping people. I suppose at least he's asking for consensual. But still, yeah, that's but not the point. Like...
Yeah, like, I don't know, he could quite easily escalate.
Yeah.
And just
yeah.
Rape. Jesus Christ.
Anyway,
this is
yeah.
a wild story.
Anyway, so this man had posted this advert. Someone using the name Lilith Handley had responded to this advert. So Lilith is obviously what we talked about, the first wife of Adam. Handley is... Is it Handley or is it Hadley? Have I just been saying a name wrong this whole time? Hedley. Fucking hell. Hedley. Yeah, so someone using the username Lilith Hedley had responded to this advert with, I have been dying to have a rape fantasy occur. Watched whilst walking my dog, following me to the door and forcing me into my condo. I am 30, tall, gorgeous and ready. I have a Yorkie who I walk every night, say 8 p.m. If you are free tonight, come and find me, force me into my house and take me down. The writer had then provided Angela and Ian's address, which, yeah. The lead detective on the case filed an attempted forcible rape complaint against Michelle. Over the next week, Angela contacted the detective multiple times to report another man had turned up at their property expecting to take part in the rape fantasy. The detective got in touch with a number of men saying that the advert posted by Angela wasn't real, or the woman responding to their adverts also wasn't real. All of them genuinely believed they would be taking part in a consensual rape fantasy. All men were very quick to back off once the police got in touch with them explaining it was a hoax, which you would, wouldn't you?
Yeah. If the police... you'd shit yourself.
Oh yeah, you would. One man even got in touch with Ian to apologize, and he forwarded some of the photos that he had been sent from this Lilith username. All had been taken off Angela's Instagram. Why you should have your Instagram set to private, my dudes.
Yeah.
So in June, police rushed to a 911 call in the alley next to Angela and Ian's condo. When they arrived, they found Angela in hysterics. She had ripped clothes and visible bruising. She said a man who had arrived had attacked her in her garage and wouldn't take no for an answer. The response he had received to the Craigslist advert had told him to ignore any screams and cries for help, as these were all part of the fantasy. Yeah. With evidence of an actual physical attack, police were able to obtain a search warrant for all of Michelle's electronic devices. She handed them over willingly, along with all her passwords. Straight away, detectives noticed an email from Craigslist asking Michelle to confirm the posting of an advert titled Rape Fantasy. This was enough for them to arrest her. The bail was set to $100,000. Michelle's parents owned a small manufacturing business. They struggled to get the money together, but they did, and then she was released at 10:30 a.m. the next morning. Her parents picked her up, but all of her electronic devices were left in police custody. Angela received no threatening contact whilst Michelle was in custody. However, within an hour of Michelle being released, the emails had started coming through again. Suspicious. But now they were worse. So before it had just been like words typed up, but now they included disturbing images of women with bruises and black eyes, women being groped by men in masks, women who were naked and being strangled, and some who looked dead. Other messages contained images of aborted fetuses with the warning that Angela's baby should not expect to be born. In some emails, the writer insisted Angela contact her and provided her with Michelle's parents' telephone number and the email address that Michelle had given to the police. So it very much looks like it's Michelle.
Yeah.
If
it's not Michelle and it's like this other like person, I'm going to like lose my shit. I'm going to be like, bro, what?
Mate. So the Craigslist ad continues, but the police are responding to the adverts themselves, hoping to gather some clues on who might be doing this. Ian was also doing this, but the police advised him against it. It was just an unwanted interference in the investigation. The police responded to another call from Angela and apprehended a 17-year-old man lingering outside the condo, again, expecting to take part in a consensual rape fantasy. After this, they decided they had enough evidence to arrest Michelle. In July 2016, Michelle was charged with assault with intent to rape in commission of a burglary and six other accounts of attempted rape and criminal threats with intent to terrorize and stalking. The maximum sentence she was facing was life in prison and her bail was set at $1 million. To get her out, her parents would have to provide 10% of the bail, which was another $100,000. They believed Michelle was innocent and had been framed, and vowed to do whatever it took to have her exonerated and freed. But obviously they couldn't afford her bail and to pay for like the private investigators and detectives and lawyers. So Michelle agreed that she'd have to remain in prison for the time being, but she didn't do well in prison. I'm not going to go into that, but basically it's just standard. She's quite a shy, small little creature. People thought knew she was in prison for all those stalking and threatening a pregnant woman and stuff, and they just was she was basically treated like a sex offender, and she was in the section with the very worst inmates, and then she wasn't provided like menstrual products in time, and she just basically got treated like shit. And whilst she was in prison, numerous press outlets ate up the story of a twisted love triangle and painted Michelle as this absolute psychopath. Yeah, some of the stuff they said is really horrible, and compared it to the book/film Gone Girl.
I've read the book and watched the film.
Yeah, it says stuff like, not only did Hadley solicit men for rape, she ensured them the best possible chance of success, providing the couple's Anaheim address, photos of the wife and details of her daily routine, telling them to strike at times she knew the victim would be alone. Prosecutors said several of the men who responded to the rape ads showed up at the victim's home with the intention of raping the victim, but did not succeed. And they call her horrifying and depraved. And they also, the media camped outside Michelle's parents' house. They weren't very nice to Michelle. I mean, at that point, kind of rightly so, but she's not actually been trialed at that point or anything. And the district attorney told a publication called The Daily Beast that the police did a very thorough investigation. With what was presented to us, we have enough evidence to prove this case to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt. This case just shows some of the dangers of social media and the online world we live in now. So she was in prison for about a month, and then Michelle's father searched online for a lawyer who could clear her name, and he settled on a guy called Michael, don't know how to say his name, Gisty. Anyway, he visited Michelle and heard her side of the story, which was very different from what the media were reporting and what the police were saying. So now this is Michelle's side of everything that happened.
Okay.
So she said it started off as a fairy tale romance. He showered her with love and she felt very safe and protected by him. However, he soon became very controlling, dictating her style, what she wore, how she had her hair and her nails. He made her get her belly button pierced and controlled how much she ate and drank and how often she slept. He often woke her up in the middle of the night so she could attend to his needs or just watch TV with him. The disrupted sleep patterns then caused her to be lethargic and confused at work, so that obviously affected her performance and her marketing role. When he wasn't with her, he monitored her movements. He had her buy all Apple products so that he could track her. He had all her passwords so that he could access all her computers and phones whenever he liked. He had cameras installed inside the condo so he could watch her remotely. She also suspected he had put a tracker on her car because as soon as she went somewhere other than home, work or college, he would call her to question her. He kept at least 4 firearms in the condo and was armed at all times. He used to turn up unannounced to her office, often in uniform, which again was very disruptive. When he wasn't with her, he would send her loads of messages harassing her, including dick pics and other unwanted pornography. He urged her to give up the job she loved to work at Disneyland. And because she was so exhausted from the lack of sleep and the controlling, she finally gave in as she just didn't have the energy to fight him on it anymore. Right from the beginning of the relationship, he tried to pressure her into having sex with other men and recording it for him to watch. Michelle had zero interest in this and grew increasingly upset by his insistence. Like, apparently every time she worked away, like, he would say, oh, go on, just like find a stranger and hook up with them and film it for me. Yeah,
that was getting like really stressed.
I know, he's just an asshole. Eventually she actually agreed to do it for him for his Valentine's Day present. So he just found a stranger willing to take part via Craigslist. Ian dressed her up in a sexy outfit. He fitted 3 cameras in the bedroom and then he watched remotely from the bathroom whilst the stranger entered the apartment, had sex with Michelle, then left. Michelle was so traumatized by the event. And she described it as being like rape because she didn't want to do it. She was coerced into it. She said she never wanted to do it again and asked Ian to delete the videos. He was really angry that she'd referred to it as rape. He told her he had deleted the videos, but she later found out he still had the footage. And he then started to use it to blackmail her and taunt her. So to try and get her independence back, this is when she signed up to some night classes at Chapman University. Ian hated this and would create arguments on the nights that she was supposed to go so that she'd feel bad leaving him. He continued to pressure her to have sex with other men, even though she's already said she'd done it once and she didn't want to do it again. So this obviously caused her great emotional stress, which they later diagnosed as her PTSD. They tried going to therapy together, but Ian got angry at her for talking about the things that were causing her stress. At this point, like, she leaves. When she left, he destroyed any belongings that she had left in the condo. He cancelled her car insurance without telling her and did other things that just made her life more difficult. He also told her that he had people at Disney monitoring her and her job performance closely, so he's threatening to get her fired there. She tried to get her life back on track, but she was scared of Ian retaliating to her leaving. So this is when she told campus security not to let Ian back on site. Remember, he got that phone call.
Yeah.
This is why. She ended up self-medicating with alcohol, but then this led to her mental state spiraling downwards, hence the mental fire and brimstone Lilith and the devil emails. So she in the end, she was pleased with the agreement on what to do with the condo, as it would all be over and sorted. So she sent Ian a reminder email close to the July deadline, stating her intention to enforce the property agreement. The communication triggered a breakdown for her, which was when she ended up in Arizona. The medical staff there diagnosed it as a trauma-induced episode and worried for her safety, which is why they contacted the police about Ian, because they obviously saw her. Around this time, Michelle started receiving weird and suspicious electronic communications. So she got messages from LinkedIn and an unknown email account urging her to warn Ian's new wife about what he's like and how dangerous he is. She received a notification saying her email was the assigned forwarding address for an email address she'd never heard of. She responded asking who it was, but got an auto reply telling her the account had been deleted. This happened multiple times with different addresses, different email addresses. So
yeah,
getting more and more suspicious here. She's confused and scared. So she quit her job. She gave up her night classes and she just moved back in with her parents. I mean, I would too, because this is kind of scary. On the 1st of June, she received an email notifying her of a restraining order hearing against her being filed by Angela Diaz. At this point, Michelle had never had any contact with Angela. She'd never seen her. She'd never spoken to her over email or phone. And she'd only recently found out that Ian even had a new wife. 2 days later, on the 3rd of June, Michelle found out Ian's application to take over the mortgage had been rejected. As I said earlier, this should have automatically triggered the selling of the property, but it didn't. And then 3 days later again, a police officer who she recognized as being a friend of Ian's turned up at her parents' house and gave her a temporary restraining order, despite the hearing not having been held yet. There was no evidence or allegations attached to this document she received. It just told her to stay away from Angela. So she's a bit bewildered. Like, she's like, what the fuck is this? I've never been near Angela. Later that day, she received an email from an account that was supposedly Ian asking her to come to the condo so they could talk. She suspected it was a trick to get her to break the restraining order, so she didn't go. She also received a call from a detective asking her about several email addresses that they believed belonged to her that were sending the threatening emails to Angela. She said she had no idea what he was talking about, but she had also received suspicious emails and implored him to check IP addresses because she was sure she was being framed. He just told her a different detective would be assigned to investigate this. So he's not listened to her at all. She rang the Anaheim Police Department on numerous occasions and left lengthy voicemails for the assigned detective stating her fears that she was being framed, that she was being set up to violate the restraining order, and that she was scared it would escalate. She continued to receive strange emails about accounts she had never signed up to and sent many, many reports to Microsoft to get them to look into this. She even filed a complaint referral form to the FBI requesting they research the IP addresses linked to the case because she was having no luck with the police. She had no response to this. She also sent an email to the Department of Justice to complain about Ian, saying, Ian Diaz does not respect the boundaries of the law, so I am extremely scared for my safety and also afraid of being framed for a crime I did not commit simply because I was the victim of someone in law enforcement who understands the system better than I do. The next day, she sent a follow-up email outlining how urgent and serious the matter was, and she just received an automated thank you response, nothing more. She then attended the hearing for the restraining order, where Angela and Ian had brought a crowd of people to shout abuse at her. This was the only time Michelle and Angela met face to face. Angela just threw a bunch of papers at her, and this was the first time Michelle had any visibility of the emails and photos she was supposedly sending to Angela. She was shocked and sickened by what she saw because she's got no idea up to this point. This is when she received the email from Craigslist to verify an ad named Rape Fantasy. So the reason she didn't delete this email was she could show the police. However, when they turned up, she soon realized they saw her as a suspect, not a victim. This is when they confiscated all her electronic equipment. They told her someone had turned up at the condo and tried to rape Angela. Michelle was shocked and asked after Angela's welfare, but the detective just concentrated on the emails, specifically from an email address, enrdiaz@gmail.com. She explained she had no idea what the email was for. She'd been receiving emails from that email address, not sending emails from that email address. She said she had left multiple messages on Detective Lee's voicemail and was correctly able to give them his extension when they questioned her on it. Detective Lee just looked sheepish and said, "Looks like I'm in trouble tonight." So they obviously didn't believe anything she was saying. They just really were just not listening to her. So they arrested her. And then in the car on the way there, she kept explaining that Ian was trying to frame her for the very crime he had committed against her, which is tricking and coercing her into fulfilling an internet stranger's rape fantasy. When the detective asked her if she'd ever reported that incident to the police, she explained she hadn't because she was too scared of Ian, which is fair enough. And then, as I said earlier, this is where Michelle's parents were just about able to pay her bail, and she was released at 10:30 the next morning without any of her electronic devices. She barely left the house, only going with her parents to the manufacturing workshop, and wasn't in contact with anyone, as obviously she didn't have her phone or laptop or iPad. When they came to arrest her shortly after, her dad tried to explain this, but they just wouldn't listen. So her lawyer believed her. But as far as the police were concerned, they'd caught the right person. They didn't want to look into it any further or do any follow-up investigation. Angela had stopped receiving any threatening emails as soon as Michelle was in custody, and no more randoms from Craigslist turned up. So for the police, it was done. But luckily, Michelle's lucky. Well, she's not lucky, but she's got good parents. So Michelle's parents and lawyers worked tirelessly to gather evidence that she had been framed. They believed the key was in their IP addresses, but the police stated that because a VPN had been used, it made the tracing of the IP addresses impossible. Her parents drew up a spreadsheet of all the dates and times each email had been sent, which IP addresses were attached to each one. And they managed to catch a break when they noticed that one of the emails was sent when Michelle was in one of her night classes. So she would have been unable to use her phone at the point when it was supposedly, this email was supposedly sent.
Yeah.
So they insisted that the Anaheim police take Michelle's claims more seriously and provided them with this information. Along with pressure from Michelle's lawyer, there are enough disparities in the evidence that the district attorney's office had the detectives revisit the case. As they investigated, they uncovered more and more evidence that seemed to point to Michelle's innocence. So the police had never been able to find footage of the man who attacked Angela in her garage. There were security cameras in the alley behind the condo, which would have absolutely captured the man entering the garage as she claimed, but there was nothing there for the date or time that she said it had happened. Angela's injuries from the attack were only minor, ones that could have easily been inflicted by herself or by someone who didn't actually want to hurt her. The timestamp of the first email sent to Angela after Michelle was released from custody was 11:28 a.m. There was clear footage of Michelle sitting on the steps of the police station in full view, waiting for her parents to pick her up at this time. She's quite clearly not got any devices in which she could have used to send the emails. So how could she have sent those emails? An inspection of Ian Diaz's phone showed that it had an app called Hotspot Shield installed on it. Guess what that does? Obscures IP addresses. Police also found intimate images of Michelle on Ian's phone, despite him swearing he had deleted them all. If you're no longer with someone and you've got intimate pictures of them on your phone, you need to delete them because you no longer have the right to those photos.
Yeah, it's, but men are perverts, aren't they?
Yeah, it's just creepy as fuck.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I agree.
They then got results showing where the IP addresses that had sent the incriminating emails were. Some of the emails came from the condo that Ian and Angela shared, and some of them came from Angela's father's house in Arizona. So clearly not Michelle, because Michelle would not have been in that condo, and she would not have been at Angela's father's house in Arizona. As they uncovered more and more evidence proving Michelle's innocence, obviously Ian works in law enforcement, so I think some of the detectives... And Michelle had previously said that actually some of the detectives that turned up at her house, were she recognised them as being Ian's friends. So obviously they are probably updating Ian on the case. And then all of a sudden on the 30th of September, he walks into the police station and tells them that he has doubts about Angela's sanity, stating that he now had reason to believe she had been sending herself the emails and was framing his ex for stalking. He had found out she'd been lying to him the whole way through the relationship. So what had sparked his suspicions was she had told him her car was in the garage when actually it had been repossessed. He then found out she didn't have a job at the courthouse, as she had told him. She had loans and credit cards that were in another man's name. He had received an email back in February from this other man's sister claiming that he was in a long-term relationship with Angela, and they just found out she was cheating on him. She was never actually pregnant with twins. Had bought the positive test and the sonogram images from a prank store on Etsy, which is just disgusting. Like, don't.
Yeah, you don't do shit like that. It's not okay.
No, I mean, a lot of this is not okay, but that specifically... Yeah. Is really not okay. He also provided the police with timesheets showing that he wasn't home at the times the emails were sent. However, these he filled in his own timesheets. They weren't like approved by a supervisor or anything. It was, or they weren't electronic necessarily.
Yeah.
So yeah, basically there was now overwhelming evidence that Angela had been conning both Michelle and Ian. The district attorney now began working seriously with Michelle and her lawyers. So after 88 days in prison, Michelle was released. In January 2017, after months of fresh investigation, Angela was finally arrested. At this point, she was no longer with Ian and had moved back to Arizona. She was charged with kidnapping, false imprisonment, perjury, forgery, grand theft, falsely reporting crimes, and framing her husband's ex-fiance. I mean, I feel like the kidnapping and false imprisonment were, there's a whole other story here, because neither of those things are really involved in this case. So it sounds like she's been up to a lot of shit.
Probably. I mean, she's probably a repeat offender.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't be the first time.
Yeah. Well, according to the news reports, she seemed very unconcerned by all of this. So the district attorney read her a statement that she had made earlier in the year where she had claimed Michelle had ruined her life and should be a registered sex offender. And when he read this out to her, she just laughed and she seemed really unbothered that her actions had almost destroyed the other woman. She sounds like an absolute psychopath. Yeah. Michelle was then publicly exonerated and they held a press conference in order to update the press on what had actually happened. Because, like, if you remember, I said earlier, the press absolutely ripped into her and were horrible and said all this information about her. So the press release just said stuff like, this is a complex and detailed case. I'm not going to go into all the details, but I want to make sure, however, that Ms. Hadley is cleared in every possible way. She is the innocent victim of a diabolical scheme. So at this point now, like, Michelle's free, even though they've told the news everything happened to her and she was exonerated. She can't get her life back on track because she's got this huge criminal record that's not wiped yet. She can't buy a car. She struggled to get a job because she can't explain why she was off work for 3 months because she was in prison. It really has ruined her life. But over time, she began to take her life back and put her own story out into the world. In February, she appeared on Dateline, a leading current affairs program, where her and her parents stated plainly that they believed Ian was just as guilty as Angela was. In July 2017, Michelle Hadley filed a lawsuit in the Orange County Superior Court against the city of Anaheim, as well as Ian and Angela, alleging that she was falsely imprisoned and lived through a traumatizing nightmare because of the couple's accusations. Michelle was seeking unspecified damages, but she was also determined that someone was going to pay for the hell that she'd been put through.
Which is fair enough, though, because I do agree that Ian was responsible for, like, being just a narcissistic dickhead.
Oh, and then
you've got Angela, who's like a fucking psycho.
Yeah.
Poor Michelle. Wild ride, I'm telling you.
She just broke up, rightfully so, broke up with her idiot, controlling, abusive boyfriend and then gets all this back at her. But Angela pled not guilty. Like, the audacity when they have clear evidence against you. Yeah. Her lawyer tried to shift the focus onto Ian being the main culprit. I mean, he does definitely play a part in it, but basically her lawyers asserted that emails on Angela's phone showed that he had asked her to participate in sex encounters with him and another man, to which she had responded that she would do anything for him and she was okay with it if he was. Like I said before, the timesheet that Ian said he had filled in was a bit suspicious. It wasn't good evidence, so there's that. But then prosecutors pointed to the extensive trail of lies, fraud and deception that Angela had left, including the fake pregnancies, an invented employment history, repeated infidelities and forgeries. They also presented evidence that this was a well-established pattern. So apparently in the past, they had this video, one of Angela's friends that had been taken years earlier. Her friends had undertaken an intervention in which they confronted her about lying about having cervical cancer. She had gone so far as to shaving her head and had posted photos of herself going through chemo before she was caught in her lie. She had also defrauded a previous boyfriend, which was another police officer, who had a special needs son. She convinced him she was an attorney, and when she told him she was battling cancer, he let her move into his home, which he rearranged to accommodate her demands. He was oblivious that at the same time she was telling her friends that he was beating her. So basically, she's trying to plead not guilty. However, no one believes her. So she was accused of Well, the crime she was accused of carried a potential jail sentence of 12 years. Bear in mind that Michelle was potentially going to face life.
I'm not even going to get into it.
No.
That doesn't make any sense.
So she pleaded guilty in the end to 10 felony and 22 misdemeanor charges, including kidnapping, false imprisonment, forgery, perjury, and falsely reporting a crime. She got 5 years in prison.
What a joke.
Yeah. And throughout all of this, the district attorney is still saying, if it wasn't for the hard work of the police force, then the truth of this case wouldn't have come to light. But bear in mind, at one point, they were like, Michelle's in prison, we're done with this now.
Bullshit, though, because it's like, what do you mean hard work? You're having, like, citizens having to find the best lawyer who believes in their case to be able to get some kind of resolution to someone being falsely imprisoned. Don't get it.
Yeah, so that's the story. I think it's recently come out, like, last year. I mentioned Michelle had put in, like, she basically tried to sue everybody, and she won.
Good, I'm glad.
Yeah, her federal lawsuit, which was an amended version of a more narrow complaint she filed in California state court in 2017, alleges that her ex-fiancé, Ian Diaz, a deputy US marshal, was so hell-bent on punishing her after their relationship dissolved that he plotted to frame her for stalking and threatening his new wife. She believes that in arresting her, the Anaheim police ignored Diaz's masterminding to protect their fellow lawman, becoming a weapon in his torturous campaign. And it goes on to talk about... it's like police protecting police, isn't it? Like, they just automatically believed him because he's a policeman and their friend.
Look at all those people that have been shot by police, and the justice that they don't get. Like, it's very much the same in this situation. Like, oh, he's a policeman. He's very proud to be a policeman. He's walking around in his work uniform when he's not, on shift.
What a dick.
Like, you're just a policeman. There's nothing special about you. You just work for the law, you reinforce the law.
Do your job properly. So the police, the press, fueled by sexist stereotypes, portrayed the case as a catfight between two women, the result of a love triangle gone bad. And it was all about crazy women, when actually I reckon the mastermind behind it all was Ian.
Yeah, he played a key part in it, 100%.
Oh, yeah, he did. I'll put the links to the BuzzFeed article and some other articles on how it about her court case with all of them and getting her own back, basically. Well, say getting her own back, but like getting the truth out there.
Yeah, bless her. Compensation for it.
I know. Yeah. Horrific. People are horrific.
Absolutely.
The internet is horrific.
I just, you just never know a person anymore. Like, they're just, it makes you not want to trust people. When you hear stories like this.
Especially in people you meet over the internet.
Yeah, I don't get it.
Yeah. So that was a wild, wild
that
ride.
That was a journey. A journey and a half.
Yeah.
That was insane.
Because at first you're like, oh my God, Michelle is insane. It's definitely her. She needs to calm the fuck down. And then you're like, oh my God, poor Michelle. What the fuck is wrong with Angela? And then at the end, you're like, I mean, Angela is still an absolute psychopath, but it's bloody Ian that is also a dick.
That's like, that was a roller coaster and a half.
Yeah.
That was insane.
Yeah.
What do you think the lesson?
Today's lesson is, don't get married to someone that you've met less than a month ago on the internet.
Yeah. It takes about 5 years to officially know someone. Through and through.
Yeah.
Don't get married someone within a month.
No.
That's shit insane.
And another lesson is, I can't remember what I was going to say. Oh, take no for an answer. If someone says no, they don't want to do something, don't keep trying to force them into doing it.
Consent.
Respect people's boundaries. Consent matters. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Don't be a weird stalker creep.
Sit with us.
You can't
sit with
us. I feel like this was quite a heavy episode this week.
It was. I enjoyed talking about it.
Me too.
Like, stalkers are wild, man. Got too much time on their hands.
Yeah, and they think too much of themselves.
Absolutely. That's the narcissistic behavior coming out, that is.
Yeah. We definitely now need to do some ghost stories or vampire type shit again to balance out.
Yeah, I mean, we still haven't done werewolves yet.
Yeah, werewolves. Let's do werewolves.
We can do that. Do that or like cryptids.
Yes, cryptids. Or cryptids. Anyway, we need to try and remember our sign off now because it's been 6 months. I don't have a would you rather, because I feel like when it's true crime stuff, it's unless it happened in the 1600s and is about like witches or some shit that happened then, it's a bit too sensitive a topic to do a would you rather on. Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Gin and Spooks. Please head over to our Instagram, which is at Gin and Spooks, where we will put a little photo dump of everything we've talked about in today's episode. That will also be on our blog, which is ginandspooks.wordpress.com, for those of you that don't have Instagram. And we'll also put our sources for our info from the episodes on there.
If you have any drink suggestions or ghost stories of your own, you can email them to us at ginandspooks@gmail.com or send them through on our Gin and Spooks Instagram page, and we'll read them out at some point when we get more stories.
We've got a good little collection going, but it's just not enough to fill a full episode yet, so please
bring them in. Please, I want to hear that spooky shit. It can be anything that's paranormal, supernatural, true crime related,
or just a bit weird.
Could be about you, a family member.
Yeah.
Anything.
A weird health condition you might have? I don't know. We like it all.
As long as they're not weird skin conditions, because no.
So no psoriasis stories.
Yeah. Yeah. Nothing skin related. Or yeah. Sorry. No.
Anyway, on that bombshell.
Anyway, bye.
Bye.